Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is a Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Yes, and I figured there's no way we were going to go with a light comedy this time. I wanted to go with something serious.
Huh? Yeah? I think you hit hit it just right on that.
Oh, perfect.
Hit the nail on the head.
King Lear.
Oh, my gosh.
King Lear.
Oh, written by a
famous fellow named Shakespeare. Yeah, that's great. So yeah. The version we watched was the Ian McKellen version from 2008. And I think, was it BBC? I think he did that.
I think yes, so, because it showed on,
yeah.
And it showed on great performances in this country, they
and
said.
And I got most of the way through the Anthony Hopkins version too, which is...
Oh.
Fairly recent. So this play was 3 hours long in the Shakespeare or the McKellen version.
It sure was.
The Anthony Hopkins one is only an hour 40.
Boo! I feel like there was a lot of mumbling by fools and insane people on the moors that got ignored.
That's right. They cut out. They had to have cut out a lot of that. I wasn't really paying too much attention to what they cut out, but it was really good. Anthony Hopkins was Lear, and Florence Pugh was in there. She was Cordelia.
Oh yeah.
Trying to remember some of the other names, but it was good. It moved at a pretty good clip.
Which do you like better, Anthony Hopkins or Ian McKellen?
Boy, I think Ian McKellen is fantastic. I mean, these Shakespeare plays, like when we did Macbeth, I watched a few of them. Because I was really in this Macbeth thing, and you know, we saw Ian McKellen do Macbeth, you know,
we did.
And then we saw, or I saw, oh, what is his name? Fassbender.
Oh, Michael Fassbender.
Yeah, Fassbender did it, and that version of Macbeth was it's really cool just to see how they play it different, and the same line can mean a different thing, or a similar thing, but different emphasis, you know. Depending on who's playing it. So I think that's fascinating to see.
And I could see that being something where the director is so important, because watching Lear, I noticed that there were many moments where a character was silent but reacting to something. And it was really well picked up by the cameras in this production. And I thought, oh my gosh, we know exactly what she thinks of this,
yes,
or he thinks
right.
of this. And so it went back to the thing of, you can read the plays, but you really need to see the plays.
Agreed.
And it hadn't occurred to me to watch more than one, because, you know, I'm kind of semi-resistant to it.
Well, it's just so dang tragic.
But man,
I mean, I'm just... You know, when I watch someone else do it, it's like suddenly I'm understanding meanings a little deeper. I feel like, you know, we're doing this podcast right now, but I feel like I've just broken the surface of this one. And it's like I'm digging in and I'm just finding all of this stuff. And, you know, it just seems endless, which is, I think, is why Shakespeare just endures, you know. But there's, this play says so much, to me anyway.
I was just letting the things it said drift.
Yeah.
Very dark clouds across my mind.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
But it does. And there are moments where it is extremely bleak, but the thing is that the bleakness just allows the few moments of joy or tenderness to really shine.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Like at the end.
Yeah. So how shall we approach this? We probably should have talked about this before, but can we give a synopsis?
Yeah, give a quick synopsis.
Okay, the quick synopsis is, we have a King Lear, which is based on a legend, I understand. So we're pre-Christ. were before mm-hmm. Christ. And so there's this king, and the king is 80-something years old. I can't remember exactly. He mentioned it, but I forgot the number.
Ancient.
Yeah, so he's old. Let's just go with that. And he's got three daughters, and he has decided that he's going to split his kingdom in three. It's time for him to retire. He's not planning to withdraw completely. You know, he's expecting certain things from his daughters. But he's like, I'm going to go ahead and back away from the daily duties, let's say. And he decides to split his kingdom into three pieces. And with these three daughters, in the famous opening scene, he decides that to ask each one of his daughters how much they love him. And that'll determine what piece they get or how big a piece or whatever. But he's divided it into thirds. So the first two daughters, Goneril and Regan, are very effusive. they love him a lot, right? And they say so.
More than anything.
More than anything ever that ever happened. And Lear, Lear happily gives them both, and they're both married at this time, and he gives them both their third. And then he turns to his youngest daughter, his most beloved, and Cordelia, and says, okay, you know, what do you have to say that can get you an even better piece of my kingdom, right? And she says, well, nothing. Right? Nothing. And he says, nothing. Well, nothing will get you nothing. Think again. And then she basically explains, I love you like a daughter loves a father, right? I love you like you're due. And so she's being truthful. And he basically gets furious. And she's not married at this time, by the way. She gets furious. He gets furious and disowns her, banishes her, gives her hand in marriage to France. And he says, you know, okay, go ahead and take her, France. You know, she's not going to have any dowry or anything like that. And he banishes his beloved daughter. So then, just in a short synopsis, what happens then is he is basically shunned by his daughters, treated as an old man that's a throwaway. He's going mad throughout the play, losing his faculties. And he's basically traveling through this final time in his life through treachery. And I'm not sure what else to say. Would you like to add in? There is a subplot with
there
Edmund.
There is a subplot with Edmund. Well, mm-hmm. with it's the Duke of Gloucester, I guess,
mm-hmm.
is one of the king's compatriots who has always served him and loved him. And the Gloucester has a son through marriage, who's Edgar.
Yeah.
And then he has, what do they call it always, a natural son, meaning out of wedlock, and which he's making great jokes about at the beginning. And and this, he's like, but he recognizes him.
Yeah.
He loves him. He introduces him to people. So he's not hiding him. But Edmund is extremely resentful of the fact that he's not a legitimate son. And so he's scheming in order to take down his father and his brother so that he can become the Duke of Gloucester.
Yeah, he wants to be treated like a true son, right?
Right.
He's like, I'm deserving
for
of this.
The inheritance, right.
Right.
And so what this does is it makes a really kind of interesting counterpoint to the Lear story, where mm-hmm. Lear has all his natural children and he wants, you know, their extreme love and admiration, and Gloucester is giving his son his love and everything, but in both cases they get turned on by their children.
Yeah,
so
isn't that something?
It's kind of an interesting contrast.
One of the things that I've noticed in this play is that I forget what you call them, but they're doubles, right?
Yeah, that's the doubles. They're,
okay, doubles. Right. So things happen twice a lot in this play. Like,
mm-hmm.
like Lear banishes Cordelia and then he banishes Kent, right?
Mm,
and
yeah.
he's betrayed by one daughter and then he's betrayed by another one, right? And then that's after all this has happened, when he visits one and then visits the other. And then there's two people that are disguised, right? We have Kent.
Oh, yes.
And Edgar. And then right. we have two characters that go mad, although one is pretending, right? We have mm-hmm. King Lear and we have Tom O'Bedlam, right, who is Edgar.
Right.
And then we have the vicious scene with the eye plucking, right? One eye yes. gets plucked, and then there's an interruption, and then they do the yeah. other one, right? So, I mean, but there's just these doubles everywhere. So you call in Edmund and Lear a double is one that I hadn't thought of. And but you're right, of course. It's just this relentless repeating.
Yeah. And I hadn't thought of Edmund as being that way, but you're right. He does want that love. So it's in that sense, that's kind of like a little triangle. Because I was thinking of Gloucester, who's kind of like the opposite of Lear, in that he's recognizing his son, even though he's not, you know, a natural son, or he's not his legitimate son.
Yeah.
And he's getting scorned by him, too, just the way Lear's getting scorned by his daughters.
Right. Right.
Yeah, so it's just kind of one's giving love and one wants to receive it, but both of them are treated like dirt.
Exactly. Yep, and then Lear.
Each has one kid who loves them.
Yep, exactly. So it's this chaotic family drama thing. And but even that, you know, as we sit here and describe what King Lear is about, it's like Shakespeare is just so much more than that in this. Well, probably every play he's written, but the, you know, it's hard to just say, well, that's what King Lear is, you know, because there's so much here. And again, you know, I feel like I need to watch it even yet again. I don't feel like any expert, but I had three things that I wanted to talk about specifically.
Oh, okay.
So one of them is Lear's experience with God. And then the second one is wisdom through suffering and blindness, right? It's kind of related, blindness, both physical and metaphorical.
Yeah, and there is a whole section. You're right. I hadn't really thought about it because I was busy taking in the horror of the whole thing.
Right.
Where I'm just like, what could happen now? Mm-hmm. Holy crap, now they did this.
Yeah.
But they talk about blindness a lot.
They do, yeah.
And then they talk about, but see with your ears.
Yeah.
See with your fingers.
Right. And this wisdom that they gain through that suffering is what opens the eyes.
Right.
Right. Or, you know, so mm-hmm. that's something that I was glomming onto. And then the last one is just this idea of this passing of an institution. Because clearly Lear, it doesn't spend any time talking about Lear's past. You just have to glean what you can from the first scene. It's like, here's a king who seemed to have been really successful, and he's getting ready to, this institution is now closing, right? And we are passing it on to the next generation, but the next generation is not at all prepared to deal with this, or not at all educated, or they're not going to do it like Lear did it. And the thing is, I don't know what Lear's past was. At some points, you know, some of the things that Lear does makes me think he was maybe a bully. And in fact, I saw this little snippet of McKellen just talking about King Lear. It looked like it was years before he did this version of King Lear. But one of the things he said, you know, he hits people, right? So he says, I think he's kind of a bully. You know, or was in his past. At least that's what it was in his head doing the character. But whatever this was, it was a successful institution. He's ready now to pass it on. But his progeny, with the exception of Cordelia, is not at all mature enough to actually do it. And I think that that's a thing that we feel sometimes throughout history. You know, even maybe now might be a time. It might just be connecting in my head. You know, it's like democracy. Are we good enough to keep it? You know, I forget who said that, right? Are we good enough to keep it? So here we are, you know, our mature people have
seemed to have moved on. Now you have a country if you can keep it, right? Yeah,
and it's like, you know, so we're not ready to have it. So if you don't mind, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, I do. But one thing I want to say, when you said what Ian McKellen was, his interpretation, I always find that interesting. Although I don't always necessarily agree with it, because I think in the instance you mentioned, Shakespeare and his time and how people acted is not really how Ian McKellen's necessarily going to interpret it.
Agreed.
I liked the idea that he was just, you know, he was being himself and the hitting the people. And yeah, I didn't love it, but mm-hmm. it was what it was.
Right.
There's a book called Shakespeare, The Man Who Pays the Rent.
Okay.
This is by Judy Dench and somebody else who I can't remember who he is, but they're good friends. And they were having all these conversations about her playing so many Shakespearean parts.
Hmm.
And I think it was going to be a book, like a written book, and maybe it is, but there's an Audible book, and there's somebody, actually a different actress, who's reading Judy Dench's part in the conversation. She sounds just like her.
Oh, that's great.
But they go through all these different plays and her experience of playing the part. And so in that process, she's also giving her thoughts on what the character was like, based on all these other things. And it's really interesting. I mean, and I don't always agree. Like, she talked about The Merchant of Venice and just kept going, oh, so racist. And I'm like, but for the time.
Right.
But for the time.
Interesting.
But but that doesn't matter, because she's talking about also, how did she play the role?
Yeah.
What was she thinking of? What was the interaction between the different characters and what they did? And she's just got amusing anecdotes too. So,
oh, cool.
I just wanted to recommend that.
Thank
while
you.
I was remembering
it. In fact, I think I would love that a lot.
Yeah. So,
you bet.
I think one of the things I wanted to talk about, and I think this is covered in all the things you're saying too, is how do we react to truth? And how do we tell truth so that people will hear it?
Right.
And I don't know if I have more to say than that, but think of how many times...
We'll be able to touch on that for sure.
When people are talking about... they do or don't like what somebody says based on if it matches up with what they would like to hear.
Yeah, and I think that's part of this passing of an institution, you know? But
it's also part of human relationship.
Agreed.
And character, and who are we, and can we take it?
Yes. Yeah.
So, sorry.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
No, I love that. I love it. So, if we start with Lear's experience with God, I thought this was really interesting to me, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, what we have at the beginning, right? He's stable, he's successful, he's the gods are on my side kind of a guy, right? And mm-hmm. we see that when, after he banishes Cordelia and then Kent starts to talk to him, Lear says, you know, by Apollo and by Jove, you know, so he's like, I am, you know, these folks are on my side. I am the king, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's on that. And then the things start to occur, right? So Cordelia leaves. He's got his other two daughters who go to their new fiefdoms or kingdoms or whatever we want to call them. And he visits one and then he visits the other and he's rejected by both. So then he ends up, he flees and he's out there hanging out, he takes his clothes off, right? He's hanging out, right? So he's in a storm, and this is just, I thought this was just awesome, right? So he's in a storm, and Edgar is there, but he doesn't know it's Edgar. He's Tom, okay? And so he's talking to Tom, and he says, "Prithee, go in thyself, seek thine own ease." So he's like, get inside. "This tempest will not give me leave to ponder on things would hurt me more. But I'll go in. In, boy, you go first, you houseless poverty," right? "Nay, get thee in." And then he says, "I'll pray, and then I'll sleep." Right. So he's like, "Leave me alone. Yeah. I need to pray." Okay. And what does he pray? But he says, "Poor naked wretches, wheresoever you are, that bide the pelting of this pitiless storm, how shall your houseless heads and unfed sides, your looped and windowed raggedness, defend you from seasons such as these?" And then he says, "Oh, I have taken too little care of this," right? So it's like he's realizing that the poor experience this. And he realizes, I have taken too little care of this. And he's doing this in prayer. And it's as if, you know, this is before Christ, right? But it's as if he's, you know, because we would believe even back then, if he was praying, whether he knew it or not, he'd be praying to God. Because those gods didn't exist, right? So,
and I think surely that's what the Elizabethans would have been taking also. They're also supposed to think,
yeah,
I don't experience what the poor experience, but I should think about it. Yeah.
So he's, to me, it's like he's discovering Christ's philosophy through prayer, you know, take care of the poor. And I have not done that, right? And then he says, expose thyself to feel what wretches feel, that thou mayst shake the superflux to them and show the heavens more just. So he's like, now at this point, and show the heavens more just is something to me that is a change of heart for Lear. Because one of the things that I thought was really interesting is their, you know, with the gods, Apollo and Jove being on our side, they're talking about fate and things like that. Like, oh, whoa, why is this happening to me? Right. But yeah, they're thinking, they're not realizing that they're doing it, right? It's not God doing this to you. These things that are happening are because of people, and you're one of them. You know, you're one of the problem. But because of their feeling that God or their gods are running the show, it's just like, well, whatever, you know, this is just how things are. And, woe to me that they would do this to me, but it's really them doing it to themselves. And this is, to me, him realizing that, and show, it's like, I need to do the thing to show that the heavens are more just, which is new, right, for Lear.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's a change. Mm-hmm. It's a change for him.
Yeah.
And I just love that when I thought about that. And then at the very end, there's this beautiful moment. I mean, it's tragic as heck, right? So now everybody's dead.
Everybody
we've mentioned so far is now dead. No, not really. But all Cordelia.
Kind of draped all over they've all brought everybody out who we cared to see. They're lying all over the place.
Right.
It's really awful. Yeah. Yes.
So here we are. So now we're in Act 5, Scene 3, right?
Yeah.
And Lear is weeping over Cordelia.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, and my poor fool is hanged, you know, no life. Why should a dog, a horse, a rat have life? And thou, no breath at all. And he's talking about his daughter. Thou, it come no more. Never, 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 never. Okay. So he's basically saying, I am never going to see you again, ever, ever, ever. Okay. And then he says, pray you undo this button. So he's talking to somebody, and the person undoes his button. And now I think he's having a heart attack.
Right.
Right. So he's dying now. And he says, thank you, sir. And then he says, and this is one of those things where it depends on what the actor and the direction is, right? He's looking at her in the version we saw, and he says, do you see this? Look on her. Look, her lips. Look there, right? He's seeing her, and you could easily show this as him looking off into space, right? And seeing her, right?
Okay.
And now dying, having seen her, is like, I'm going to go be with her now, right? But the way that this play did it, it was like, is he going mad? Or is he actually seeing her? To me, bringing the Catholicism that I carry, I'm looking at this and I'm saying, he sees her and he's going to her, right? That's where he's going.
Yeah, that's interesting, because my first time through the play, I just thought he was looking at her and he was seeing her in a sense of the way you mean, but I just thought he was looking at her and going, he really was seeing her for the first time.
Right.
Not just my daughter, who I love so much, and she's so cute, and she's so whatever, and we love each other, and blah, 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 blah. He was really taking in the whole person.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is in a, it's not exactly what you're talking about, but it's that clarity of really seeing somebody for who they are and the truth of who they are.
Yeah, and that's very nice too. But I was interpreting, listening to that saying, sure. Oh, these are the last words of a person, and he sees her, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, actually, look there, you know.
Yeah.
That's how I took it, even though that's not how it was played. McKellen didn't play it that way.
Well, you know.
You know, but I thought it was beautiful if that's the way it could have been.
I like thinking of it that way. No, and I like thinking of it that way, and I think that's more what you might have seen back in Shakespeare's time, because they were more free with things like spirits and so forth.
Right. Yeah. So,
because
so
that's the idea when you were saying the storm, and he's talking about the poor and everything, but also because nature would have been reflecting what's going on Earth. Mm-hmm. So the storm is the storm of on the kingdom. Everything's being broken apart, and it's very stormy, or everything's freezing, and it's, if it's bright and sunny, everything's going great, which also would have been an action of the gods, if we're talking about gods before Christ.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and you can also look at it as, sort of like what we think about with the desert. You know, I mean, the rain seems the opposite of a desert, but it's nature, right? So. Yes. When Jesus went out into the desert, he had nothing, right? And he was, it's the same thing here. He's battered by nature and is down to his most basic level. You know, with the awe of this storm, this incredible storm, you know, which they said over and over. So it's an incredible storm. And then, being humbled before great power, right?
Yeah.
And which strips you down to your most basic. And which allows the spiritual things to come up, right?
Well, because with all the extraneous things gone, then again, you can see the truth.
Right.
About others, about who you are.
Absolutely.
And in that sense, also, I'm thinking about how wet everybody was. At one point, I was like, these actors must have been sick of having water all over them. But also, it is the rain that washes you clean.
True. Yeah. Yep. There's that symbolism, too.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Wow. You know, and that even makes that prayer even more deep to me is, you know, a baptism in a way, or this washing, right?
Yeah,
I was just
thinking of that,
Yeah, so it's like, you know, he's praying, and with this washing, he's realizing, you know, and he's seeing, again, to me, and I realize I'm Catholic, it's a Catholic podcast, bringing the Catholicism right in it, but it's like, he's seeing Christ's philosophy in my head. He's like praying, and what he's receiving is care for the poor, you know?
Yeah, and especially compared with how he was acting when we see him coming back from the hunt at Goneril's.
Mm, yeah.
You know, where, you know, that's where we kind of see him pushing people around and being all jovial and well, why is nobody here to greet me? Where's my daughter? Where are the men who are supposed to take care of us and give us something to eat and everything?
Yep.
And now, as you say, with you bringing up Jesus in the desert, and I'm thinking about this long time he's spending on, I guess it's a moor, wherever he is outside.
Yeah, I think they call that heath, whatever that is.
Same thing then.
Right, exactly.
Mercy of the elements. Mm-hmm. And Jesus could do it because he was not only, you know, perfect human, but perfect God.
Yeah.
But Lear is having to realize who he is. And that is done. And that's the other thing you mentioned. This is done through suffering.
Right.
A lot. Because we don't hear God until he's shouting. And suffering is how that happens.
That's awesome.
You can't ignore it.
Yeah, that leads right into that number two. So wisdom through suffering. And again, this blindness and truth like you were talking about. Right. It's in the suffering that Lear is going through that his eyes are opened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sight,
right. And man, is there a lot of suffering in here.
Oh.
Yeah.
so many people's hearts are broken by the ones they trusted who were not trustworthy.
Yep.
And I mean, there's a lot more suffering. There's, you know, being out on the moor and being freezing and being put in the stocks unfairly, all the things that happen, but, and blinding. So, oh, I was going to say so much blinding, a lot of blinding, but, it's the thing where, yeah, it's, I don't know a better way to say it. It's just that strips away all the essentials. You have to focus on what's basic and true and important.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Yeah, and Edmund has a line where he's talking about this feeling about the gods, and so he says, "This is the excellent foppery of the world, that when we are sick in fortune, and it says often the surfeits of our own behavior, we make guilty of our disasters the sun, the moon, the stars, as if we were villains on necessity, fools by heavenly compulsion,
yeah,
knaves, thieves, and treachers by spherical predominance." I love that. Yeah, mm-hmm. Drunkards, liars, and adulterers by an enforced obedience of planetary influence, and all that we are evil in by a divine thrusting on, an admirable evasion of whoremaster man to lay his goatish disposition on the charge of a star. And he even said, nature is my god, right? Because he's like, I'll have nothing of these gods, really, you know, because of the place that they've put me in. I have nothing of that, and I will be of nature. And then he goes on to do horrific things.
Oh, man. He was a surprise to me. Mm. I did not expect him to really be the main villain of the story.
Yeah.
But I think he surges up through his subplot when both plots come together.
Mm.
Suddenly I'm just like, oh man, he is playing all the ladies.
Yep.
And sidebar, I first saw him and I went, oh, he's pretty good looking. Later I went, oh, I get it. That's why all the ladies are going for him. You had to have a good looking guy.
Right.
Because suddenly they're just all over each other. And I'm like, when did this happen? So, he's just manipulative of everybody. And it's not that the sisters wouldn't have done it. They just weren't quite as smart. They wanted him, and he didn't. He was using them. He wanted something different.
Yeah.
So he could see past those passions.
Right.
And to have, but that's a great line that you said.
Yeah, I mean, to have him, but to have him be the one to say that is how blind everyone else was. Yeah.
Yeah, in that sense, he's the only really clear-sighted one in it, except for, there's Cordelia.
Mm-hmm.
And even Goneril's husband, although he doesn't see what she's doing until too late, still holds true to honorable feelings about the king and how he's being treated.
Right, and it's through that suffering, yeah. It's like this cauldron of all this suffering, and then the people that are left at the end have the wisdom that they gained through that. So Edgar at the very end, you know, the weight of this sad time we must obey. Speak what we feel, not what we ought to say. And right there, it's almost a restoration of truth. Right. Because early on, you know, we're talking about truth. When Kent was talking about so Cordelia was banished, and then now he's arguing with Lear. Kent is arguing with Lear.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, let it fall rather, though the fork invade the region of my heart. Be Kent unmannerly when Lear is mad. You know, what wouldst thou do, old man? Thinkest thou duty? Thinkest thou that duty shall have dread to speak when power to flattery bows? Which is a heck of a way to say, flattery is what you're listening to, not truth. Right? It's like, this is the abandonment of truth right there that, that he's pointing out. He's like, truth does not matter to you anymore. Flattery matters to you.
And for that, he gets banished.
It's not regained until the very end.
Right.
You know, and then that's when Edgar says what he said, and it's like a restoration of it.
Yeah.
And then the world goes mad, chaos, total chaos the whole time. And then we can imagine that after the play that, you know, Edgar can run a kingdom in a reasonable way, we hope.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so can, I can't remember his name, but Goneril's husband.
Yes. Right. He's still there too.
Right.
Yeah. It's Burgundy or something like that.
No, Burgundy is the one who turned Cordelia down.
Okay.
I think.
Yep, I believe you.
And France took her.
Right.
But that's the thing about when I was saying I liked how many times people who were telling the truth were scorned because what they were saying wasn't what somebody wanted to hear. And the liars, which is Edmund, Regan, Goneril, people like that who lied and flattered were accepted because they knew just what to say. And the one who was really good was the fool.
Mm, yeah.
The fool spoke the truth in a way so that it coaxed people through humor and subtlety to at least listen. Even if they're just kind of laughing, he has said it. And that's, of course, the traditional role of the fool is not only to make you laugh, but they can point things out because they're fools that will be accepted from people that wouldn't be, that wouldn't be accepted from other people.
Right.
And I really liked the fool's character in this.
Me too.
Because he truly loved the king. He really loved him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was trying to, you know, open his eyes, but he still went with him out into the storm.
Mm-hmm.
And he wound up dying for him.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. There were several times that he said something to Lear that Lear needed to hear. And I thought Lear would respond angrily, but either he didn't fully get it or, did get it and appreciated it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, he wouldn't necessarily act on it, but you kind of almost think it's like a seed for later, maybe.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and so I also liked the people who were kind of more bluff and straightforward showed us something that is not spelled out when you're saying we don't know what kind of a king Lear was. But we look at Kent and Gloucester and Cordelia, who all seem very admirable because loyalty is an admirable quality. And they are so upset by what's happening to Lear once he's being picked on, even though he has kind of cast them all off because they aren't saying what he wants to hear. They're loyal to him and stick with him. And it shows what a good man and master he must have been once.
Yeah, I agree with that. That's a good point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they pity who he's becoming, and they remember what they love. And I guess this is one other theme, which is, of course, so obvious that I forgot to write it down. But it is of watching somebody who has aged and changed.
Yeah.
And
that's hard.
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. And the way you show, and it's almost like Lear right here at the very beginning is showing us, wow, he cannot have been making decisions like this his whole kinghood, or he wouldn't be 80 years old and still a king. So is this bad judgment and bad decision based on him getting older? And this is what he wants to hear. And then we see him going along, and yes, he's becoming crazier, and all these things. However, and as you say, he's seeing the truth underneath things, but we're also seeing him become feebler, less able to make decisions, all the things as we're watching him decline, and it's like it's compressed.
Yeah.
But as somebody who lives with somebody who's going through a lot of that right now, who's my mother's been living with us for 5 years, she's 90 years old. She just had a pretty serious illness about a month and a half ago. And she's coming back from it and all this stuff. But I watch each time there's a bit of a decline.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I saw with Lear. It's just like it all got shoved into a 3-hour period.
Yeah.
It's like we watched him age 10 years in that time period. And I just thought it's such a commentary on the people around him and how they treat somebody who's old and feeble and not able to manage things the way he used to be.
Right.
And that's something for modern times.
Yeah, yeah. That's really interesting. And that he was stepping down was interesting. You know, mm-hmm. did he recognize that in himself? Was it, you know, why did he think it was time? And then when a person like that does decide to do that, you know, what he expected the aftermath to be was not what it was.
I know.
So it was like, you know, I expect, you know, this retirement, I'm going to split my time between these two daughters. I mean, if we forget Cordelia for a second, mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to split my time between these two daughters. I'm going to have my nights. And, you know, then the daughters just turn on him, you know? And I thought that was really interesting too, when they're taking away his knights. And then, one of them says, why do you have need of even a single knight?
I know.
And he got really mad. Right. But you know, he said something there that it was like a man needs more than what nature gives. So it's like, right. It's almost like, you know, look at you, you're wearing this dress, you know, and you have these trappings that our society has decided that that's respectful, you know, of you and your station, right? And right. To him, this is my station, you know, you're not taking, you know, maybe I don't need knights, but that's my station, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And it's also the and friends, how devastating it was. Yeah,
right. It's also anybody who's been in a community, which we talk about all the time, of whatever it is, because of your station, because of what you have done through your life, or who you're part of right now in terms of a group. And when that just gets yanked away from you, that's one more. That's one less piece of reality you've got to hang on to.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the what was I thinking? The whole old age thing. You see Kent, who's pretty old. See Gloucester, who looks about as old as King Lear.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then you see Lear. And Lear's the only one who you see in depth. But the other two hang close to what their actual character has evidently been through their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Lear is the only one that this is all enacted on.
Right.
And maybe because he's the king.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe so. Yeah.
Yeah. So what were your other things?
Well, the other thing, I mean, so we've really talked about the first two.
Okay.
And the last one is this passing of an institution idea.
Mm-hmm.
So it, again, it's like, you know, we have this kingdom and we're passing it on to people. You know what it reminded or what came to mind? Do you remember Knives Out?
Of course.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's kind of like the same story, isn't it? Right. So we have the king die, or the elder person of the house, but none of his offspring are at all prepared to handle what he left them. And it ends up going to what we call her, the nurse. She was a nurse, I think.
Right.
But yeah, so it's kind of the same thing. And I feel like, you know, that, and that's something that, I don't know, maybe I'm still sussing that out, but it's just this idea that, you know, his two daughters, not Cordelia, but his two daughters, Goneril and Regan, they knew what the game was. Immediately, you know, so, you know, how much do you love me? An immeasurable thing, an impossible thing to answer. And right. They answer it with gusto, and they know what they're doing. But what's on their mind is not, it's the superficial, right? It's like riches and lands and all this other stuff. They have no idea what it takes to run the place at all. They haven't been prepared, or just went wrong somewhere. I'm not sure, but that's what they are. They're like, I want this. And their lusts come out, you know, with Edmund, you know, so they're not following any of the societal norms at all. They're, you know, they have no regard for anything except for, you know, basically sex and power and money. So,
and one sister never was without a wine cup. I noticed that.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Yeah. That's pretty good. In fact, she even used it at the end to poison her sister.
She sure did.
Yeah. So anyway, it's just that idea to me is something that I just was thinking about, and I just think is really interesting. You know, if we look at that in like just today's society, you know, the United States of America, let's say, we think, you know, well, the United States is this idea that we can have a society where people don't agree, but we agree on these laws and we move forward, you know, this this philosophical idea that this can be done. And then you know, as time goes on, it's our responsibility to pass that on to the next generation and the next generation. And then there's that idea, you know, democracy, if you can keep it.
Yes.
Right. So, but that's a super macro thing, but you know, there's these micro things too. But it's just an idea that I've been just thinking about ever since I watched it. And I saw his name is, you remember Klavan? We did a book of his.
Yeah. Andrew Klavan.
Yeah. Yeah. The Great Good Thing or something like that. I think we did an episode on that.
Yeah. Was that his autobiography coming to faith? Right.
Yeah.
Right.
He's got a little 15-minute talk on King Lear, and he was talking about this idea.
Does he?
Yeah. He was talking about this idea too, this idea of this passing of an institution. And he, by the way, he was the one who illuminated that prayer of Lear's was in that video. He talked about that too.
Okay.
It's just this idea again that we have this next generation to prepare for the future. And if they don't have the same philosophies, I don't know. I'm not sure exactly what I'm trying to say there. It's not that they need the same philosophies. I mean, change is going to occur, but there's got to be some respect for the institution.
Virtues.
Right.
They need the same virtues.
Yeah.
So they need the loyalty. When you look at the good characters in here,
uh-huh.
I think what you're making me think, and yeah. I don't know if this jives with what you're thinking, but look at Cordelia, look at Kent, look at Gloucester, and how faithful, and the fool, and, you know, the good people in it. There are very few.
Yeah.
But they're faithful, they're truthful, they're loyal to a fault. They will put themselves out to do the right thing and support their king.
Yeah.
This is what we're looking for. This is what we want. And what we're getting, a lot of the time, is all the rest of it instead.
Yes.
And these people, this kind of goes back to, it kind of intertwines with something that I'd forgotten to note, but I was thinking when I was talking before about people don't like somebody who says the truth, but they like to be flattered.
Mm.
That is our society right now.
Mm.
That's kind of what social media has done. We lie about who we are so we can look good and have a nice vacation
on that we do.
Whatever we're showing, Instagram or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The politicians all are, you know, saying the nicest things to everybody. Now, this goes back to the beginning of time, I would say.
Sure.
So it's not like we're unique. But when I looked at that play and I thought about how people were responding to hearing truth or lies, and I thought, this is us. Because when they hear something they don't like, different groups in our country, then they just start to eat their own. They throw them out and they revile them. And it just, they don't realize how badly it reflects on them.
Mm.
You know, somebody who just doesn't agree with them down to the nth degree.
Yeah, yeah.
This is also happening all the time.
Yeah, all right.
You cannot make everybody happy, and you have to take a stand, and nobody wants to hear it when you say what you really think.
Mm. Agreed,
so then you get all this kind of weird situation.
Yeah, so I mean, yeah, that ties into so many things. And, you know, so the way that I look at it, I mean, if Cordelia took over the kingdom, I have no doubt that she would change things moving forward, right? But there mm-hmm. was this respectfulness of the institution,
mm-hmm.
this respectfulness of how things were. And, of the, you know, the manners or whatever we want to call that. But yet, yep. you know, the new generation is certainly going to change things moving forward. You know, it's, right. it's not a set thing, but without the basic, philosophy or the basic ideas, having bought into the basic ideas of what this is in the first place. You know, it's just, you're destroying it. You know, it's like, I've heard things, you know, another quote that I remember is something like, once a tradition is, named a tradition, then it's going to die. Right. Because there's the people that are going to rebel against that. Right.
Yes.
You know, so it's just like, well, that's just that we don't need to do that anymore. We don't, you know, without
understanding. And that's really a modern thing too.
Yeah, I think it is too.
Very modern approach.
Yeah. Yeah. But, everybody in this play, just about, you know, other than Cordelia and Kent and probably Gloucester. Mm-hmm. But Gloucester himself was blind before he was blind. So,
yes.
you know, that's a thing, right? You know, they just weren't ready. They weren't the right people to take this thing over.
That's so. True. You know, when you said Gloucester was blind before he was blind, I suddenly remembered this one bit of the play that I just thought was such an act of psychological genius, is when his son, as posing as Tom Bedlam, finds out he wants to find the nearest cliff and throw himself off. He's going to kill himself because he can't see.
Yeah.
And he pretends that they're going up a steep hill. And he's like, oh, it just seems level to me, says Gloucester. And he's like, oh, no, I'm tired out from climbing. And he pretends to... he pretends that he's fallen off the cliff. And he's like, well, you floated down like a feather, sir, with a different accent.
Yeah.
It's a true miracle. You're not dead. And he suddenly changes everything and says, oh, well, then I was saved for a reason.
Oh, wow.
This goes back to your religion in it.
Yeah.
And he says, I will therefore, you know, go on and live.
Yeah. And, that's you know, funny. Yeah, so as I was poking around, learning about stuff around the play, I found a fellow who was saying that this, you know, when we're watching this scene in a the way we did, you know, with you know, on film, he said it's not going to have the same effect as it did on the stage in Shakespeare's time, because in Shakespeare's time, the stages were bare. They weren't rolling sets out or anything like that. So for them to describe you're on the edge of a cliff would be something that they would normally have in a play, right?
Okay.
So now they're on the stage and they're like, is he on the edge of a cliff? Is he not? Is it flat? You know, what's going on? But the description that Edgar gave would be that they would believe that. And then the guy would jump off the cliff. And then he would, you know, they got up and said, oh, you were saved. It would have had a kind of a different effect, you know.
They wouldn't have known whether or not to believe it, or they would have believed he jumped off the cliff.
They would have had the anticipation that he's really on a cliff. It was clear that he was not, because Tom O'Bedlam is the one who...
He comes around
and takes a new voice and says, you know, hey, I'm here at the bottom of the cliff now. They would realize at that moment that there never was a cliff. But all the way up to that moment, they would have thought there was one.
Oh, yeah. You would have had a whole different set of anticipations and everything. That would have been great.
Yeah. So I thought that was an interesting thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because they're used to having the scene described to them.
Right, that does make sense. And I did love the description. The men look like mice. You know, so realistic. I loved it.
Yeah, so good.
Yeah. Well, and some other scene, since I was describing a scene, I was practically crying over Cordelia and Lear at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Not when they're saying he needs to wake up, or we think he can wake up now, and she's like, oh, sir, do you not know me? You know? And she's so tender. And he... when he realizes it's her, is so loving and sweet and sorry for what he's done. He's seen everything. He's back to more of his normal sense of mind.
Yep.
You know?
Yes.
And the part where also when they go, who is it who says, is it Edmund? it's Edmund, I think, who says, well, Cordelia and Lear's back there. And he, I think he's looking for redemption himself. He's been wounded. And he says, you know, Cordelia and Lear, because they're like, where are Cordelia and Lear? Where are they? And he says, oh, they're back at the enemy camp. And if you take my sword, it will act as a token to bring them here. And maybe you can save them. And they say, let's pray. And everybody just stands there or kneels with their hands in the air.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was very effective.
It was. Yeah.
You could see their hope and desire and and longing for this to work.
Yeah.
And I myself was like, I thought they both died, but I hope it's true too. You know?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. That was a good moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But alas, the action
it
of
was
men,
a tragedy.
The action of men to, did not
yeah.
get thwarted.
You don't get to have it's a happy like ending if it's a tragedy.
Free will, right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We're not going to fix your free will issues.
Free will. Yeah. Oh, no, wait. I'm Catholic. Free will? Yeah.
It's like, man, we cause ourselves problems.
Don't we, though?
That we do. Yeah.
Don't we?
Man. Mm. Well, there's so much more to talk about in this play. And again, I know I'm scratching the surface, and I really want to dig in a little further.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I didn't see all the things that you saw in there, but again, it was my first time through, and anything complicated, I think, you have to go through, of course, and get the basic story.
Yeah.
So that then later you can relax, and I know what that is, and look for the other stuff. So
yeah, for sure.
So I was glad you had all that.
Yeah,
to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, it was fine. I got it from various places too, but the I'm not done with this yet. I'm still gonna poke at a couple more performances and just look at it. I really think the play is amazing, and it is tragic, and we're watching a lot of suffering. And a lot of pain and a lot of maddening blindness.
And sometimes there isn't an answer for that stuff. And that's something we didn't talk about either. But as Catholics, we know suffering happens to everyone no matter what.
Yeah.
You can try and protect yourself, but you just can't live like that. Life breaks through. And, you know, and if you do protect yourself enough, then you're bored, then whatever. So you're still not happy. And the only, we talked about some of the good things about suffering, or the, let me say, the benefits that occur from it.
Right.
Because suffering is so hard and nobody wants it. But this is part of offering your suffering in union with Christ's suffering on the cross is it benefits us, but we can also offer it for others. And in this play, I think you see that other people are suffering with Lear. They don't have to, but they're supporting him in it.
Mm.
And the suffering that he's going through, by the end of the play, he is prepared to seek Cordelia's forgiveness, and they resume their loving relationship as father and daughter in a way that they couldn't have before.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that's the benefit of all that suffering and all the blindness is torn away by it. So
beautiful. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
Wisdom through suffering. It's hard.
Damnation through stuff. These people, other people all want the stuff.
That's right.
And what they get is damnation.
That's right.
That they bring on themselves.
Yeah. My precious.
Yes. Exactly.
Yep. It's all connected, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So good.
So after Lear, do you have another play that you're kind of interested in that you might dive into?
I mean, I love all of them. Did we, what have we done so far?
We did Hamlet.
Hamlet. And we did Macbeth.
Mm-hmm.
And this one. So we haven't done any of the comedies.
Those are harder, I think.
Yeah. Like,
not
you know,
always, but
Much Ado About Nothing, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
like
well. I like the Joss Whedon version.
Oh, that would be fun. Let's do that.
Yeah.
Well, we'll talk about that next year, but that would be fun.
That sounds good.
I'd do that version for sure. I've seen that one live.
I have done my part.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Have you?
I love it. Yeah. We have a Shakespeare festival that I have never been to. it's not like super close. It's got to be like a 6-hour drive from here. It's in southern Utah, but man, I want to go to that.
You should. You like it so much.
Oh, I love it. Yeah. So, yeah, I want to get down there. I just haven't. It's just one of those things that just never happens, but I need to make it happen.
Yeah, you have to put it on your calendar far enough in advance that you actually plan for it and do it, like you do with your conventions.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely right.
Switch one out.
Good point. Yep.
You know.
I love it.
Yeah, and for me.
Yeah, what would you do if you were picking one?
Well, this year I watched Throne of Blood, which is Shakespeare. It's Macbeth from Kurosawa.
Oh, very cool. I have not seen
and
that.
It was good. I liked it a lot. It was really interesting because it was so Japanese.
Ooh.
But you could see all the elements. I mean, but it's so Japanese. Wow. You might really like it. And very cool. Yeah. And then the other thing, I would like to see Throne of Blood, although having seen King Lear. I would like to see Ran, which is his King Lear, though now having seen this, I'm not sure anymore.
Because it might be a little tragic.
Yeah, well, just a touch. But anyway, so, and then the one that I think we should watch maybe sometime is Hader, which is Hamlet, Indian style.
Okay. Oh, very cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm in for that for sure. All right. So what's next up for us? The End of the Affair by Graham Greene.
More light storytelling.
Fantastic. That's good. We're getting into fall now, so.
Oh, we are.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, this is a story that Hannah forced me to read. I'd been avoiding it, knowing how dark Graham Greene can be, but this is so good.
Oh, good. Yeah. Okay.
Very good. Hannah and Rose are going to be with us on it. So.
Oh, I love that. That's going to be fun.
Yeah.
A very good day.
Yeah. Well, maybe I won't talk very much. No. Maybe they'll do all the talking. That might be a good day, right?
Oh, stop. Not even. Love it. All right. Well, good. Looking very much forward to it.
Yeah, and I'm glad you picked this. I was really dreading it, but except for some of the mad scenes, which seemed to go on, I really enjoyed it a lot.
That's good. Well, good. I'm glad.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everyone.
Yes, we'll talk to you again soon.
Yeah, back in a couple weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm.